ARUP Institute for Learning presents Insight,
Education,
Leader,
Pain Management,
Technology,
Experiment,
Esoterization,
Informatics,
Body Research,
Excellent.
Laboratory Medicine.
Join us as we delve into emerging topics presented by ARUP medical directors who are faculty in the Department of Pathology, School of Medicine, and other highly qualified expert contributors.
This is Golden Welch. I'm here with Dr. Maggie Hopkins and Dr. Gwen McMillan. Today we're here to discuss cases in toxicology and considerations for clinicians in interpreting toxicology results.
A common question that I get on the Path On Call service is for a patient taking oxycodone, and oxycodone plus metabolites are present, but there's also a small positive for hydrocodone. This can indicate an impurity in the manufacturing process rather than the patient surreptitiously taking a drug which they are not supposed to. Can you explain that in a little more detail, Dr. McMillan?
Sure. That pattern of results is also something that we can learn from doing confirmatory testing that generates concentrations for the specific analytes. And it's a really important one to recognize because many don't realize that the U.S. Pharmacopoeia allows drugs to be less than 100% pure. And in the case of oxycodone, it is allowed for about 1% of the oxycodone to be hydrocodone. Now, with our very sensitive LC-MS/MS type assays, we can very easily pick up that pharmaceutical impurity. And it's not indicating that the patients did anything wrong or took anything that they shouldn't. It truly reflects impurity of the pharmaceutical product.
In the case of patient B, why was the point of care screen giving a negative result for benzodiazepines?
In this case, patient B is receiving clonopin, which is clonazepam, which is, of course, a benzodiazepine drug. Although the urine point of care cup included an assay for benzodiazepines, the primary metabolite of clonazepam, which is 7-aminoclonazepam, reacts poorly with the antibodies utilized in the benzodiazepine assay, which makes false negative screen results very likely. For example, due to the poor cross-reactivity of 7-aminoclonazepam in immunoassays, the concentrations necessary to produce a positive result must be 13 times the reported cutoff concentration.
Of course, the sensitivity of an immunoassay to a particular analyte will vary from product to product. And so while the 13 times greater than the reported cutoff concentration cited by Dr. Hopkins may be true for one assay, another assay may require 20 times the reported cutoff concentration, and a third assay may actually detect the 7-aminoclonazepam at maybe the cutoff concentration itself. So it's very, very important to always reference the package insert for the actual test being performed to understand what the sensitivity and specificity is for the analyte of interest.
Dr. McMillan, what are some of the reasons for a negative or falsely negative result?
There are several different possible reasons for an unexpected negative result. We've already talked quite a bit about the variations in specimen quality as well as in the analytical methods and how they may contribute to apparent false negative results. One of the things that many folks are concerned about is adulteration. Certainly in traditional drug abuse testing, adulteration is a major concern. And the most common form of adulteration is overhydration. So in this case, a patient would take copious amounts of water to produce a very dilute urine specimen that would push the concentrations of drug below the detection limits of the test. For this reason, most laboratories will offer some sort of test to evaluate dilution of a sample, and most commonly that's creatinine or specific gravity. Patients may also do other things to adulterate urine and prevent drug detection. In a drug abuse scenario where they want to mask use of illicit drugs, they may add things that will change the pH of the urine and thereby prevent interaction between the drug analytes and the antibodies upon which immunoassays are built. They also may add things that will introduce noise and therefore prevent detection. A third approach would be to add things like oxidizers that can actually destroy drugs, and a few of these are known. In the pain management population, We're more concerned about adding things to the urine that may mimic compliance rather than hide inappropriate drug use. So sometimes patients will add the actual drug directly to the urine after voiding to mimic compliance. And we can identify that when we perform confirmatory testing by the presence of only the parent drug and no metabolites. Another practice that's become fairly common in the pain management population is for patients to archive their own urine and thereby substitute a urine specimen when they know they're taking the medications they should, and avoid providing a current specimen that may disclose things that were inappropriate. There's really not much that the laboratory can do to identify a substituted urine, particularly when it's archived urine from the patient itself.
When would it be appropriate for a clinician to call the lab about unexpected results?
Well, as we've seen, there are a number of reasons for a result to come back as not as expected that don't have anything to do with whether the patient has been compliant or not. So this always warrants a discussion with the patient with no accusations at first, just to get their side of the story before making any assumptions. And then a confirmation testing and consultation with the lab is appropriate.
Certainly additional testing can be useful. We can collect timed blood specimens to evaluate pharmacokinetics for an individual patient. We can perform genetic testing to identify genetic variations that might explain an interesting metabolic phenotype. We can perform some specialized testing to look for adulteration, agents that may adulterate the urine. So it's always useful to call the lab to discuss any unexpected result.